this episode of The Half-Life Show, we talk to Priyanka Shetty, an actor, director, and playwright who left her secure software engineering job to pursue a life of acting and theater performance. Her latest touring play is The Elephant in the Room, which was recently premiered in the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland, and is a solo performance, a one-woman show, which is a tale of her search for identity with deeply embedded Indian roots and finding context and common ground in America. In this podcast episode, we hear tales from Priyanka's show on the road, the things that go wrong, and how the show must go on no matter what. We also go back in time to discuss how exactly Priyanka transitioned from software into a life she always dreamed about as an actor. We talk about how to deal with criticism constructively and the power that words have in people's lives and how inspiration takes many forms. It takes a lot of courage to pursue our dreams, and we are always in awe of people who do, especially when they do it for the love of art. We hope you enjoy this episode. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Half-Life Show. Now on to the show.
Priyanka, so we are doing this recording right now on a Monday, and you're coming off of an incredibly busy weekend, right? So thank you for sitting down with us and having this chat.
Thank you guys for having me. Like I was saying before, I think this is a welcome change. All the craziness that happened last time, and I'm looking forward to a nice conversation. I can just sit down and talk to you both. Very excited.
That's what we do on the show. So you're in the right place.
Yeah.
Relaxing.
This is fun.
Conversation.
So could you tell us what you were up to this weekend?
So I had about 6 performances of my solo show, The Elephant in the Room. It's a one-person play that I've written and which I also perform. And this was the New York City premiere of the play. So the idea behind this set of performances was it's a preview performance for people to experience the work before it heads to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe in Edinburgh, Scotland. So yeah, it went really well. There were 2 weekends of performances and a lot of people showed up. Most of them were strangers who I have no idea how they found out about the show, but we had 2 fully sold out weekends of performances, which was amazing.
That is fantastic.
That's incredible to have an audience that is just rearing to go and to see you perform. And you just mentioned it's a one person or a one woman show, right? So no pressure there for you.
If you mess up a line, it's all on you. No one's there to help you out. But there's a unique thrill to it about performing solo and holding a full hour of an evening or afternoon on your own and engaging with the audience. It also can be very lonely because the process of coming up with a solo show, you write it alone, you rehearse alone, sometimes without a director present. And the moment it stops becoming lonely is when you step on stage and you have the audience with you. That's when it becomes from solo to communal, right? So that's one of the thrills of doing solo performances. So it was great to have just spent 6 of those hours with a full audience in there who are also listening and responding to you in that moment. And it's like a shared experience, really. And each show feels different based on who's sitting in the audience. It's amazing. Yeah.
And this performance that you just had in New York, it was at a pretty well-renowned theater. Right?
Yeah, they are a Drama Desk award-winning, very reputed theater in New York, off-Broadway theater. And they have this festival every year called East to Edinburgh, where they invite performers from the US, maybe mostly East Coast and New York performers who are taking a show to the Edinburgh Fringe. And they offer the space to us, and then the performers get 100% of the box office sales, which is also amazing. So it really, it's recreating the circumstances that you have and the parameters that you have to work with in Edinburgh Fringe, where it's also very touch and go. You have to come, set up, strike, and leave because right after you, there's another act performing. So they try to recreate that experience for us here so that we are already kind of primed when we get to Edinburgh.
Yeah. This is something that even Vikram and I experienced when we were part of a band, Black Earth, playing music. When you perform at a popular venue, say like 59 East 59, that's what it's called, right? 59 East 59? Okay, so if you perform at a big stage, the patrons who come to these places are seasoned patrons. They regularly watch shows. They have certain expectation out of it. And if you think you've done well in, well, from a personal, you know, bar, measuring yourself kind of a thing. So if you go to a big stage and if you think you've done well, it is a good feeling because you have, it's really good feedback. You're getting this feedback from seasoned patrons.
Yeah, and also it's kind of like you're putting yourself out there. If you bomb, then it's going to be pretty bad because they know what they are coming into. They're seasoned theater goers, like you said, and word of mouth is everything in theater. And I don't think our second weekend would have sold out if the first weekend hadn't gone on well. So it was, while it was amazing to be in their presence and share my story with them, it was also a little intimidating to be in New York, especially with reviewers coming in and everything. New York critics have a reputation for ripping apart shows. So, but that's part of being an artist, right? You're kind of at everyone's mercy a little bit. All you can do is work on your craft and put it out there, and the rest is not in your control.
You just mentioned about the nerves, right? Does that ever get easier? Like in the sense, you've done a ton of performance at this point. You've performed at a big venue, sold out shows, and you have sort of performed the elephant in the room multiple times, right? Does it ever get easier? Like, so you've performed two shows every day on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this last week. So was Sunday easier than Friday in terms of the nerves, or was it still nervous going on stage?
I'm dreading the day that I don't feel, I hope that day never comes, because I feel like if I'm not feeling that little bit of butterflies in the stomach and that nervousness and that giddiness before stepping on stage, then I wonder if that's when I stopped caring. But the nervousness and all of that comes because you want to do a good job. You want to be in your element. You want to be present with the audience. I hope I never get complacent enough that someday I don't feel that. But at the same time, I also want to be in a more relaxed place before stepping on stage. And this time it was really difficult doing that because, like I said, the turnaround times between each show was so short. Sometimes I would get there and the previous, like if this happened yesterday, the members who were part of the previous production were still in the dressing rooms. Their stuff was not out of the theater in the given amount of time. And we just had to wing it. I was sitting there steaming my robe in outside the theater, and I didn't have access to a dressing room to ground and center before the performance. Maybe I got it like 5 minutes before I had to go on stage. So there are a lot of such variables, and it requires a certain amount of grittiness, kind of like what musicians need too, because there are so many variables when you perform on stage as well, right? That no matter what, the show must go on. The audience should never guess that anything has gone wrong before the performance, or even during. Like the one of the shows that happened here in New York, you won't believe this. So we have house music that plays, right, as audiences come in and enter. So during the show, during the very second scene, so it was very early on in the play, the beginning of the play, as the sound cue was supposed to move to whatever the next sound cue was on in the play, the house music starts playing really loudly. Oh my God. Right? And I was like, okay, it's fine. I'm on stage and I'm like, we'll improvise. We'll pretend that this was intentional. And it doesn't stop playing. And it's playing at the loudest volume ever. And I continue to act as if nothing has happened. And I'm going on with my lines, pushing my voice so that it's louder than the music. And it goes on for 5 whole minutes.
Oh my God.
For the entirety of that scene. Yeah.
Crazy.
And at one point I'm like, do I stop? I mean, if the entire show, the entire play cannot have this music playing in the background, because the story has to move forward. And luckily they managed to figure it out after 5 minutes. But there was one scene that was completely engulfed by this loud blaring house music. But such things happen. And the whole idea of the show must go on. Yeah. It really is true. You have to run with it and embrace things that were not scripted or part of the plan, and still give the audience a good hour-long performance without being fazed by any of these things.
I'm actually curious, how exactly did you recover from this 5 minute of house music playing in the middle of your act?
I pretended it was the background score to the scene. So whenever the music shifted and changed, I sort of changed my responses accordingly and my line delivery of whatever was coming up next accordingly. And literally when I spoke to people after the show, they just thought it was part of the play, but it was just at a louder volume than it should have been. So they thought that this was intentional, but it was just a technical issue that it was a little too loud. And they never guessed.
You totally succeeded.
Season theater people were like, oh, I knew. I guess so. But at that point, I was really losing it. I was like, how is this going to happen? And this happened on the night that a lot of industry professionals, a lot of artistic directors were in the audience to see me. And I hope it was still an okay of an impression that I made on them that night.
As musicians, whenever we try to write our music and stuff and perform, one of the things that at least I have come to learn over the years is play stuff that's about, say, 50 to 60% of your actual ability. So if you were in your perfect environment, you have this ability, right? Now, if you're actually performing, you have to scale that ability down. You have to perform at 50% because you need the headspace. You need the headspace in to consider your surroundings, to account for the unknown, to not be able to prepare, to account for tiredness. So all of this stuff, you have to plan in advance to keep your abilities in check so you can account for these other things.
I think that's 100% true for actors as well, because especially with something like Edinburgh Fringe, right, where you're performing every single day for a month, you are going to have off days. And if you are constantly just always at the edge of your limits, there is going just probability, right? There's going to be a day when you're not in a place where you can hit all of those marks. So we also, I think, especially with solo shows, operate in that 50 to 60%. Of course, we have a lot more to offer, but it's how much you've developed your craft. And that 50 to 60% shifts and changes as you become more and more, as you gain expertise in your craft, right? As time passes and the more you put
it. I don't think I can agree with this 50 to 60% because at least as a part of a band with Vikram on it, if he is performing at his 60%, I need to perform at 100%, right? I mean, the amazing guitarist that he is, and we also
have I know all about his amazing abilities, yeah. Right?
So the only way I could get through it is just practice the heck out of it so that it becomes muscle memory, essentially. I think this, I'm sure this is similar for acting as well, right? I mean, you just practice the heck out of it so that you're in some sort of, you let muscle memory take over and you just go through your motions during the day and not think about the performance at all.
Yeah, but you know, there's a downside to that. There's something about, and this is probably true for musicians too, is that you need to be, like, it can't become, you can't be on autopilot. You have to, or you can't, this has to be manual gear, right? So the moment, and it's so palpable when you're sitting in the audience, that you can tell that an actor is not in it moment to moment. So the challenge is that, yes, it has to become second nature and you have to develop a grasp over it with practice and with rehearsals. But when the moment comes, you have to perform as if this is the very first time you're saying these words.
Okay.
Because what happens is with acting, if you're not present in the moment, saying those lines as if those thoughts are just occurring to you in that moment, it becomes rote. So when the audience is watching you, they know that you're not in it. You're just saying your lines and you're moving from scene to scene. And I find that with solo performance especially, it's so important to be in the moment and really not be on autopilot and allow those thoughts to come to you as if for the very first time. And what helps is who's sitting in the audience changes, right? So they are your scene partners in that moment. So the way they are listening and responding to you feeds how you're going to say your next line. So that really helps in staying with that. But it kind of is finding a middle ground between the two, where yes, you have to practice and rehearse and be at a very good place where you can consistently hit those points in your performance. But there's also an element of improvisation and staying in the moment where in this moment, this is what is inspiring me to say my lines in this certain way. Or maybe you change something up completely. Like one of the lines I talk about is jaywalking in India and how in America it's possible to get ticketed jaywalking. And someone made it, I think it was one of the reviews that said, oh, but jaywalking is just walking in New York. And I was like, I didn't even think of that. So the next performance, I acknowledged that, except in New York, it feels just like home or something like that. But sometimes things like that happen in the moment because... Okay. Like yesterday, my final performance, there's something that I fling from behind the dressing screen and that hit the flower vase and the whole thing came crashing down in the last scene. And I had this line about, so in my play, at the end of the show, the actor or the character Priyanka is about to get on stage to perform the play that he just saw. So that's how it ends, spoiler alert. But I talk about all the things that could go wrong on stage. And one of them is the need to pee in the middle of the show, right? And exactly right before that line, the water came down crashing. And I used that as something that inspired that thought that, oh, shit, what if I need to pee in the middle of the show, right? So there are things that you just have to think on the fly, which is kind of is the fun of theater and solo performances.
That's amazing. I think we have to put a name to this amazing performance of yours. It's called The Elephant in the Room.
Yes.
Right.
That's right. I didn't even mention it.
That's important because if your show comes to the listener's neighborhood, they have to go check it out.
I would love that. Yeah.
Yes. So that is amazing. The Elephant in the Room is one of three plays you have, and the other two being hashtag Charlottesville and The Wall. So these are the three things you have going right now, which you will premiere in 2023?
Yeah. So the plan is for it to be a nationwide rollout. So the idea is we're going to recognize 8 hubs in the United States, which comprise of several cities or regions or city centers, whatever you want to call it. But the idea is that we'll have an expanding circle of launches. So as soon as I come back from Scotland and the UK after finishing the tour, I take a little break. And then the very top of 2023, starting January, we start rolling out each of these plays in an expanding circle of launches. Now, what that means is first, The Elephant in the Room will visit each of these 8 hubs. And there's going to be a lot of community outreach and educational outreach that's going to happen in conjunction with that. And then once that is done, we launch hashtag Charlottesville. And once that is done, we launch The Wall. So it really is a 3-year project with multiple theaters across the country coming together in this nationwide conversation, because the three plays are linked to each other. There's a connecting thread of race, bias, identity, immigration, all of these themes really tie into each other with these three plays. And it ends with The Wall, which hopefully will tie everything together coherently. So yeah, that's the kind of ambitious plan, kind of things that immigrants have to do.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
Consistency in employment.
Actually, so let's go into like a little bit more about The Elephant in the Room. It is a funny take on the two cultures that we live in or have lived in. The Indian culture that we have all grown up with and where we live now in the United States. And how some things just don't get along and all the differences and yet commonalities you see between these two cultures. Right. So can you tell us a little bit more about what Elephant in the Room is actually addressing and what you want to convey through the play?
Sure. It's actually a pretty specific story about, it's autobiographical. So it is a specific story of my personal transition from India to America as an Indian South Asian immigrant. And at the same time, it also has a lot of universal themes. So I think that's one of the reasons why this play has worked in the United States, and now I'm about to find out if it works internationally as well, is that even though it's a very specific story person, the themes that are explored in this, even outside of race and identity and all of that, we talk about love and loss, the death of losing someone that's important to you. So there are a lot of these universal themes that have appealed to people from different backgrounds. So the very first time I performed this play, there's a bit about Indian aunties and the way they hold the comb. And a lot of people from the African American community came to me and said, oh, I have aunties like that. So there's a lot more that we have in common than we give credit for or acknowledge.
True.
So that is one of the things. But most importantly, I think what Elephant in the Room does in the overall perspective of the triptych is that it plants the seeds for a lot of very specific and big conversations that need to be had. What I realize in a very meta way is that even in terms of my own experiences and life experience in coming to America and then tackling some of the bigger topics that America is currently grappling with, is that my experiences were a primer for the quest that I was about to go in terms of understanding why things are the way they are in this country and even globally for that matter. So shortly after I started my graduate school in Charlottesville, Virginia. I went to University of Virginia. Maybe one and a half to 2 years in is when the Unite the Right rally happened, which was, yeah. If you remember, a lot of members of the alt-right and neo-Nazis descended in that city with tiki torches. And how can we forget, right? So that was really something that I thought that needs to be written about. We need to talk about this in theater and film. But nobody was writing a play about it. And I waited for a year and I was like, we've got to address this in the theater world. But there was a lot of, like, people were hesitant to sort of get into this. And I also didn't feel like I was the best person to write about it because it cannot be my voice, right? Because I'm an outsider. And then I thought maybe there is some value in an outsider's perspective, but the words cannot be mine. So what I did was I interviewed the people, the residents of Charlottesville who were part of the counter protests and who some of them were injured in the car attack that happened on August 12th, 2017. And one of them was also the mother of Heather Heyer, who unfortunately lost her life in that car attack. So, and what I did was I transcribed all of these interviews. There were close to 100. And then I compiled them together and came up with the script of hashtag Charlottesville, which ended up being a very raw human take on what happened on those 2 days, which was not necessarily covered in any of the documentaries or TV news stuff that we had read or press coverage that it got. It was a very real and raw version of what happened on those 2 days and why the people of Charlottesville think it happened there, right? So the elephant in the room plants the seeds for something like this. There is a scene in the play where I talk about immigration and the line, "You will not replace us," which was a chant that was said over and over in Charlottesville, made its way into Elephant in the Room because around the same time that this happened, at Charlottesville, Virginia, I also faced one of the most racist incidents in my life at the academic institution that I was a part of. So it feels like they're all weirdly interconnected, and it does feel meta because that does translate into how I've approached each of these topics in the plays themselves. And now with all of the immigration stuff that I'm going through, it just feels like the wall is a next best thing to write about because I'm personally going through that. And I know a lot of people from different walks of life who are going through the immigrant struggle. And each of our experiences is so, so different. And I know we were only supposed to talk about Elephant in the Room, but it beautifully sort of connected to what these two other pieces are about. Now with the wall, I'm not only talking about the immigrant struggle here in the US and the detention centers and all of that nonsense that has happened and is happening here, but also the Hindu-Muslim communal violence in India, Brexit, and how it all really links back to its roots in colonization. So there is a little bit of that. What is at the root of all of this? How did it all begin? So the wall has a lot resting on it or riding on it in terms of putting things in perspective in a historical context too.
That's a great explanation. I had no problem with you going from Elephant in the Room to hashtag Charlottesville and to the wall, which is exactly what you did. And I was hoping you'd do that. So not to get too politically into the hashtag Charlottesville incident and everything, which is a whole different topic, and there are entire podcasts and discussions about that.
Absolutely.
What did you exactly learn about the victims of, or the people involved, or the people hurt by Charlottesville, and how did you use the feelings that you felt when talking to these people who are actually hurt by this incident, and how did that feed into your play? What did you learn from it emotionally, or what did it provide for you in your play that could be a message socially speaking when somebody actually sees hashtag Charlottesville?
I think one of the main things I learned was that, and this is something that I knew also going into these interviews, but something that was solidified even further, was how a lot of people in Charlottesville were saying these were outsiders who came into town. This doesn't happen in our town, right? Mm-hmm. There was a sort of a pushing the blame on other people from other cities who came in and did all of this and then left. But the truth is that this has been going on. Like the underrepresented communities have been treated badly for years. And this is not something that is new and that people from outside came in and did, but this was the perfect breeding ground for something like that to happen. Because even when I was a university student, I would walk down the streets and I would feel this vibe, especially in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I was like, I don't know what that is, but I can feel it in my body, that I'm the other, that I'm not welcome here, right? And people who've lived there have lived through it for those many years. So a lot of the things that came up was these atrocities against the African-American community and the Latin American community. So a lot of them were like, we're not surprised this happened here. So that made its way into the play. And someone put it very eloquently that this is where America was birthed, Charlottesville, Monticello, right? And the way Thomas Jefferson is revered, even in, at the University of Virginia, and the kind of things that he's done. So there are a lot of, like, they called out a lot of the hypocrisies of America. And what happened in Charlottesville is really representative of what's happening in America, because what happened at the Capitol, right? That's when it came back into the news. People had forgotten about the alt-right rally in Charlottesville until it happened in D.C. again.
So, I mean, this is incredible, right? We were just talking about acting and theater as an art form. But, you know, when we talk about the material and the effort that is going into writing each of these plays, the importance of what you're doing becomes more evident. It has become more evident now that you're telling us about hashtag Charlottesville and the wall and the elephant in the room, because with hashtag Charlottesville, of course, you've put in so much effort into interviewing these victims. And not only that, you're taking up the responsibility to represent their voices, right? I mean, and broadcast their message on a stage so more people sort of listen to. So, I mean, we are really proud of you for doing this important work. It's clearly a lot more than an art form or theater specifically. You're actually putting your stage to really good use.
You know, when we apply to universities, they ask us to write our personal statement, right? Why do we do what we do? There came a point when I was reading my personal statement that I wrote while applying to all of these universities. And this was before I started writing my own original work. And I felt that even though this is why I want to do theater, that is not what's happening in terms of the roles that I'm playing and the stories that I'm telling. Right. And it's always kind of dependent on what stories the theaters want to tell or the producers want to tell and what roles they see me in and end up casting me in. And I've often found that that was more problematic than in line with what I wanted to do in theater, because it was a very stereotypical idea of what I could be and who I could represent on stage. And the writing was not coming from people of color, or it was not coming, it was a lot of white playwrights. And I felt that this cannot end up becoming what my career is about or what I'm representing on stage. And there really came a point where I had to take it in my own hands in terms of, okay, if these are the stories I want to tell, and if they don't exist right now out there, or if I'm not being cast in them, then maybe it's time that I take it in my own hands and write those stories. And that's when, you know, this whole playwriting thing also became a part of my identity. Now I'm a actor, playwright, and a director. All three things.
Excellent.
That's amazing. You know, we always wonder, like, the interaction between society and art and how one can feed the other. Like, there is plenty of instances of this in music, right? Like, people have written music towards a cause, towards peace, towards being united. And because Subbu and I are such heavy metal fans, even death metal has themes. For example, Gojira is about saving the environment.
Okay, yes, I'm a huge Gojira fan, by the way.
Oh, yeah, there you go. So you know exactly what I'm talking about. They have songs exactly like about the whales and the oceans and all kinds of stuff.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it's so amazing that with any form of art you take, whether it's like heavy metal, mm-hmm. plays, theater, or we have
poetry.
Yeah, poetry, exactly. So all of this can have an underlying theme that ties into society in some way. So that is, I think, the beautiful thing about art. You know, how you can amalgamate seemingly two completely unknown forces together into one and present it as a message to people.
Agreed. Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought heavy metal into the conversation, because it surprises that there is a section in the play where it's a heavy metal scene, and then people find that out about my character, and they don't see it coming because I don't really wear my metal, I guess. But there's a moment where I turn around and I show them a tattoo of Wacken Open Air's logo that's on the... I got tattooed on the back of my neck when nice. I went there. And they're like, whoa, she really is a metalhead.
So Wacken Open Air Festival for the non-metalheads is a really big festival held in Germany.
Yes.
That brings together some of the biggest metal acts in the world. And it's really a thing to behold. I wish I can make it there sometime. It's like a bucket list item I have, but it's awesome you made it there. And next time I go there, I mean, it's not like I have been, but when I do go there, I'm going to get a matching tattoo with you.
Yes, that we can port those. No, it was amazing. I saw Gojira live there and I met them in person, and it was...
Oh my God, amazing. Wait a minute. You can't drop that just like that. That's a total bucket list item.
Okay, now yeah. I got to ask. Sorry, this is an important question. Are you a Joe Duplantier fan or Mario Duplantier fan? Which brother are you a fan of?
Of course it's Joe.
Everybody is Joe Duplantier. Nobody cares about the drummer. Joe Duplantier is the guitarist and vocalist.
But Joe is really, really good looking and cute.
He's like the Benedict Cumberbatch of metal music. Joe Duplantier.
No, don't
do that. Oh, man.
But I do... love both of them, but Joe Duplantier.
Yeah, okay, before you guys, you've already gotten into the weeds, so let me pull you guys back. Okay, so now coming back to this role of art in society, right? That's what we're talking about. One of the things that is the other curious effect of art in society is if you go through every era, right? Mm-hmm. There's sort of a theme to it. Like, for example, the 70s was all about love and peace, right? And the music represented that. And you could see that it also influenced fashion to an extent, right? You had people with bell bottoms, nice frilly clothes, and good long combed hair. And that was in the 60s and 70s. And then you go to the 80s and 90s in the time of Black Sabbath and Metallica and all of that. And, you know, people pretty much lost the bell bottoms and took up much more like shredded jeans and distressed jeans. There's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, you have art in your society, and humans being these social creatures that we are, we allow it to influence us in so many different ways, right? I mean, if you take even say like hardcore death metal and all that, there's certain kind of people that come to this kind of the open FS that you're talking about. You have a lot of piercings and a lot of tattoos, I guess, and so on. So now, so Vikram and I have, We sort of look at it from the lens of music, but how is it in theater and acting in general? You said you did your master's in fine arts at the University of Virginia, right?
Yeah.
So when you're going through this program, do you learn about the history of theater?
Yeah, we had this whole course about Commedia dell'arte and a lot of old-timey ways of the Lazzis and things like that, period drama, Shakespeare, Moliere, and all of that. But it's less academic. When you do an MFA in acting, it's less academic and more practical in terms of being on your feet and working on plays and doing scenes and scene work and objectives and actions and this and that. So while there was a little bit of history that we learned and script analysis and all of that, I don't think it was a very research oriented thing that course is not meant for that. So a lot of those gaps we have to fill on our own in terms of reading and researching and figuring out what the history of theater has been over the years. That question would be different for theater performers in India versus, you know, theater performers mm-hmm. in America. And I feel like I'm kind of stuck in the middle where now I don't have a context for what the pulse or the pulse is in India. And now I'm still trying to figure out where do I fit in terms of how art has progressed in America. So I'm kind of in the middle at this point. But I definitely feel that the focus has shifted a lot towards new work. More and more theaters are now interested in talking about contemporary issues than ever. There is a lesser focus on the classics, and people want new work, or at least work that is talking about things that are contemporary. And even classics are being recontextualized, Shakespeare and Moliere, it's being recontextualized in terms of what we are going through currently, which I think is a great trend. And I hope it continues, because like we were talking, art is connected to politics, art is connected to what we are going through as humans right now. And the more socially aware plays we are putting out there, the more I think we are becoming capable of tackling whatever it is that we're dealing with right now, right? So the trends that I'm aware of right now, especially because I'm so immersed in new work as an actor, as a playwright, and even as a director, it's become my niche at this moment. And I see more and more theaters who are interested in this kind of socially engaged plays. While there is, it is still important to entertain the audience. It can't be like they sit there and get schooled for an hour and go home. No one's going to come if that is the case. So there is definitely the spectacle of it is important. The entertainment aspect of it is important. Humor is important when it comes to really heavyweight, heavy duty topics. And that's also something that I try to bring in to my work a lot. Elephant in the Room begins with a humorous take, and it really is a comedy until it gets darker and darker. I found moments of humor in a play like Hashtag Charlottesville, which is really, really heavy subjects that we deal with. But I think that's also an important vehicle to sort of let some of those larger topics land. So in terms of trends, new work is definitely becoming a thing. A lot more and more playwrights who are creating socially relevant plays are being recognized, and their work is finding a home in a lot of theaters across America, at least.
Like Subbu's question on your Master of Fine Arts, right, from the University of Virginia. To us, it's really cute. We are really curious, I guess we would say that, what do you learn? Like what skills and how? So I have to do my due diligence, right? So I went to priyankashetty.com, which is your website. It'll be in the show notes, right? And I went right up there and I clicked resume. I'm like, all right, let's see her resume. And I scroll right to the bottom. And this is a really interesting thing I found. I totally wanted to ask you about this. Your skills say stage combat, unarmed rapier and dagger. Okay, can you explain to me what skills those are and how I should avoid them?
So it's just staged combat, right? It's staged combat. It's not actual combat. But you know, you see a lot of these Shakespeare plays where there's a sword fight or, you know, a dagger fight, or even in more contemporary plays where it's fist fights, right? So how do you stage these so they look real, but it's totally safe for the performers to engage in? And of late, another thing that people are getting coached in is intimacy. There are intimacy directors who become part of projects like the play that I just directed at Azuka Theater here in Philly, Carroll County Fix. There were some intimate scenes between a few of the actors, and you have to choreograph them and stage them so that it's being done in a safe way that actors feel comfortable repeating that, right? So similarly with stage combat, to make sure that there are no injuries, that we are not just going, if we were doing this in India back in the day, we would actually slap someone on stage, and that is so wrong.
Seriously?
Thankfully, so I didn't. Funny. I wasn't in any of the shows that needed it, but hopefully, and I'm a little cued out of how it is over there, but I'm sure they have intimacy directors and stage combat directors too, or fight directors, sorry.
Yeah.
But we were trained in that. That was part of our training. So to break it down, mm-hmm. our training comprised of three things: acting, movement, and voice, right? So movement involved all of these things. Stage combat was part of it. Period movement, how did people move in different eras, like what kind of body posture and gestures to use. So that was really interesting. We learned period dances. We learned different types of acting. And there are different acting techniques too, right? So different schools of acting. So our program was inclusive of multiple styles of acting. Some programs only focus on one. It's either Stanislavski or Meisner, but our program sort of was open to different kinds, whatever works for anyone, right? So they sort of gave us a taste of all of the different types, schools of acting. And then voice. I'm actually also, you may have noticed on my resume, I'm a certified mm-hmm. voice teacher as well. So voice and speech was a major thing. Like, how do you articulate? And dialects is a part of it. We learned different dialects. I did a Russian dialect for my role in one of the plays based on Pussy Riot, actually. You may know that mm-hmm. band.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting. 3 years totally immersed in learning all of these different aspects. And some of the semesters we'd have things like script analysis. Mm-hmm. How do you analyze a script? And
analyze it for what? I'm trying to understand. Analyze it for how it should be implemented?
So you can analyze it from a playwriting perspective. You can analyze it from an acting perspective. But the structure of the play, what are the... We would even have things like, why is the play titled this? And then we'd have to think about it. Like, it was more of a critical thinking sort of a class. But I think that really helped me as a playwright in understanding how plays were structured. And so having that, even as an actor, was helpful because it just helps you appreciate it on a new level. As you're approaching a certain character or a role, you become more aware of why they are present in the play and what purpose do they serve in the play. So it was really exciting. And I felt very privileged to be able to do all of that and have access to it. And ours was a fully funded program. We didn't have to, you know, pay anything. Mm-hmm. It was a full ride, full scholarship. And we were paid to teach undergraduate students. So it was really a sweet deal.
I mean, you earned it. It is like, it's definitely an earned privilege.
You're
putting all of that to important use. And yeah, I mean, I think you totally deserve that.
The nice thing about hearing your description of the whole program and what you learned about it, in my mind, if anybody is listening to this, I hope it inspires them to go and pursue something like this, because our entire education in literature and the arts and plays and theater, we did do some Shakespeare in school, you know, but it was not taught to us in a way that we would go and love it, for example. Maybe a few people got it out of the program in a classroom of maybe 80 people, which is what we typically had. But most of us weren't exposed to the beauty of poetry or plays or what it is and what the world is out there for somebody who likes to do plays and stuff like that. So your description of what a Master of Fine Arts program is and maybe how that connects to what you do as a playwright, you know, as a director and as an actor, hopefully is inspiring for someone to go ahead and explore what this area is. Because I know the world needs more art.
Absolutely. Sure. And I hope that such programs are also offered in India, because a lot of times I think if I did not have the privilege of being able to travel to another country to pursue this and spend 3 years doing this, what would I do, right? And I hope, and I know there's acting training that's being offered, but I wonder if academic institutions offer something like an MFA. I don't think so. I don't think that has become a thing yet. And I really hope that happens in the coming years. It is something that I would like to be involved in at some point in an educational capacity, and creating a program like that in India, affiliated with some university or something like that. But although I can't say that I can fully recommend it to anyone either, because one of the things that my play talks about is the challenges I faced as an international student in an academic environment, mm-hmm. right? Of course, they bring us into the program and they think that, okay, this is great. This is a diverse group of people. But I don't think they fully take into account that you are bringing in a person from a different cultural background and with a very unique identity. They're bringing a lot with them that you may not be fully aware of. And I don't think they fully consider when programming plays for their seasons that they need to have roles for these students. So a lot of international students in the arts have had not so good experiences in an academic setting. And they're often cast in like very demeaning roles, or they don't have the chance to fully express their identity, because it is only a certain section of who you are that makes it on stage. So a lot of times I can't take my full being into a character, because that character is supposed to be American or, you know, Western in some way, even if I'm doing Shakespeare. I remember once we were doing Tartuffe and I was cast as Doreen, which is an amazing role. And the director wanted to put her in harem pants or something like that, as if someone had brought in. And while I understand that, it is also like there's a need to appropriate, and you don't sound right, so I need to do something about it and make it fit into this, as opposed to finding plays where there is a role for this identity to be represented, or even writing and creating that, right, is something that we're still working on. So while it was amazing that I had this privilege of learning all of these things, it was feeding only a certain percentage of my whole being. I was not able to bring my full self into a role. Not all parts of me were allowed or invited into those roles, right? So it is a double-edged sword, which is why I'm hoping that these programs sort of become accessible to more people from other countries where they are too, so that we are not limited by this, that America is not the only answer or UK is not the only answer to education in theater, that we have access to this kind of training in our home countries.
Yeah. I mean, even talking about art and theater in India, right? At least like Bangalore, where all of us are from, one encouraging trend is that it seems like the appetite for the arts, like from a patron's perspective, like for people want to consume.
Yes. So
definitely the appetite for the arts has been steadily going up, at least in the big cities. So I think that generally that's a very encouraging trend, because in the last decade itself, since when all of us left India, a lot more centers have opened up, which provides opportunities for performances and things like that.
Yeah, they're doing really great things. And I think you're right about the appetite for consuming art, and especially live theater is definitely there. I had the chance to, back then it was musicals. So we did My Fair Lady, we did Fiddler on the Roof. And I don't know if you've heard of Tagore's novel, Chokher Bali, which is also a movie, but I wrote a stage adaptation of it. And we performed that, and a lot of people came and they saw it and they enjoyed it.
Nice.
So there is that hunger and appetite for art in general, but also live theater, which is great. And we have such talent in India, and it's just raw, untapped. Like, people are just naturally gifted. So I'm wondering, like, if we had access to training programs that are so immersed in building that craft over the course of several years, and if we had access to that, which was not just National School of Drama, right? What if every university had an affiliated MFA program? Imagine, like, if when we went to undergrad, if we had like Pesset or wherever else we did engineering, if they also had a drama or theater department.
So as Vikram said, right, I mean, for the listeners, you have to check out Priyanka's website. And I think you also have like a newsletter where people can sign up on your website, right? So I would highly encourage our listeners sign up for that. That way, if Priyanka is coming to a city close to you and you must go and watch her perform for sure, I think that would be a good thing to
do. Thank you. Thank you for that shout out.
Maybe we should step back in a little bit in time and see what your background is growing up. We were all kids in the same city, actually, and kind of lead us through your journey of what education was like to you. And you know, we want to know how your path took you to where you are today.
Yeah, I noticed that it was not even during college or engineering or any of that. It was as early as maybe sixth or seventh grade, and it was through literature. I had an amazing Shakespeare, like an English professor who taught Shakespeare really well. So for me, that love for Shakespeare and that kind of language and text started early. At that point, I wouldn't even have imagined that I would end up choosing a career like this. But literature became my in. And around that sixth or seventh grade, I would imagine all of these amazing stories that we were reading as part of our English literature classes, whether it was Anthony and Cleopatra. I would imagine them as characters, and I would want to play those characters. And so that really became my in. And around the same time, we had different clubs, right? Science club and drama club. So I'd signed up for drama club. And honestly, that was the only exposure to theater that I got before my MFA program in the US, that drama club where we would come up with these little ads for certain products and it would be a funny skit, or we would have to come up with a story on our own and then we would enact it. And that drama club was the best thing that ever happened. And then I switched schools and that school didn't have a drama club. So and I hated being a part of the science club. But it was kind of latent and dormant. And then flash forward, I guess, to years later. In the meantime, I had started writing and fiction became a certain thing. So it was finding its, it was manifesting in different ways. Mm-hmm. After the drama club experience, I became more of a writer. I started blogging. I started writing short fiction. I was cartooning. There were different outlets that my creativity was finding. And then it was really when I was employed as a software engineer that I read Tagore's Chokher Bali. And I was like obsessed with the character of Binodini. I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but I was obsessed with the main character in that play. And I thought, I really want to play this role because I could relate to her so much too. I was like, how am I going to play this? Because this is a novel. I was like, okay, let's adapt it into a play. And then I wrote an adaptation of the novel in the format of a play. And then I was like, okay, so we need to produce this. Then I was like, great, I will be the producer. And then we need a director. Fine, I will direct it. And then I found the entire cast, all software engineers at Infosys, which is a company I was working for at that time. And similarly, like me, they were people who had an artistic sort of inclination. Nice. But was stuck in the wrong job, I guess. And then we would rehearse in during lunch breaks. We would rehearse after office hours. And we rehearsed for a year. Over here, we rehearsed for 3 weeks. We rehearsed for a year. And then I approached the HR at Infosys and I said, so we have a play. You have a lot of these employee engagement events. So I should have done this before rehearsing. I should have lined up a gig for us. But no, I waited until we had rehearsed for a year and had a fully ready play.
You have a committed crew. I'm just going to say you have a committed crew. You have gig
ready.
Lined up.
We're ready to go on stage. Imagine if she had said no, how pissed everyone would be at me.
I know, right?
But we took that risk. And then I told her, you have all of these employee engagement events. And they had brought in theater groups. Rajit Kapoor had come in. They did love letters at Infi. And it was amazing. And I thought, why not have a troupe from the company perform on stage? And she was fully prepared to say no, but she agreed to come see it and then say no. And we performed for her in some banquet hall upstairs in one of the buildings. And she came to see 2 minutes of it. She ended up watching the whole thing. And then she said, I was actually going to tell you guys that it's not possible, but I really love this play and you've done a great job. Let's talk dates. And then we got a very small budget of 10,000 rupees. Mm-hmm. And we put up that play, Chokher Bali. You won't believe 2,500 people in the audience.
Oh my God.
They had Infi has this huge auditorium. The balcony was full. Obviously, the ground floor was full. And then the aisles where you have the staircase, people were sitting on that. They were at the doors. And then all of those people missed their evening buses It ended at like 9:30 or something. I missed their 6:15, 7:15, 8:15, 9:15 buses. Finally took the last bus back home. And when people were leaving the theater, we got a standing ovation. People rushed onto the stage. And I remember this one woman like holding my face and saying, "You're going to go really far." And that's when I realized
wow.
that, shit. So she sees me as someone who can do this as... yeah. like something beyond this play. And that's when the idea occurred to me that, yeah. oh, I could be an actor. Like someone else saw me, saw this or imagined this for me, which suddenly made it real, that as a real possibility. And I remember hearing that people were talking about the characters as they left the auditorium, not the actors, the characters. And that's yes. when you've been successful in what you did. You immerse them in the story in some way. And they were having these arguments about who was right and who was wrong. And it was great. And apparently there was a record for the number of discussions about this on the bulletin board, things like that.
Typical. Wow. You really had them in your
surrounding success.
Yeah, someone made a graph of all the different topics that had hit record number of discussions, and ours was right on top. He made a graph for it. Anyway, but that was where it began, really. That was a spark. And then they tripled our budget. We got a huge budget for My Fair Lady, and we went all out in terms of costumes and the spectacle of everything. That was a huge success. So that really set the trajectory for what was to come.
Vikram and I talk about this often, which is the impact of art, of practicing arts on a young individual, right? How important it is for our own children to pick up something. Like it could be music, or it could be some sort of drama theater, or even a sport, or whatever it is. And the reason why we feel that way is, even in our own lives, we've seen that practicing a form of art with the intent of performing it, that whole thing is such a rigorous exercise. Practicing it, and then you're going to put it out there for people to see, because there are so many lessons to be learned through that process, right? I mean, so you're practicing with the intent of putting it out live and getting feedback from people, because even when in our earlier days we sucked, right? Black Earth, oh my god, I mean, we bombed many shows, and but going up on stage, we thought that we were the best in the world, right? And we I can tell you that in the first two shows that we had rehearsed a lot. We did our first two shows, and people were very indifferent towards it. Our friends were nice to us and said, yeah, it was good. But some people said, man, you guys, no, it sucked. It sucked. And then we didn't know any better. We were young and cocky, right? We were like, these people don't know how to enjoy our music.
They don't know
too much. They don't have teeth.
Yeah.
So now, then it went from that. So, but we did this week after week, and we eventually realized, hey, okay, it's us who's the problem. We need to figure out if people don't like what they're listening to, then we got to reflect on it and fix it. And we eventually did. And then we became popular. And that whole process was important because it broke, like we went from cocky individuals to taking good feedback and criticism. And we learned to take disappointment. I mean, I think that if we didn't go through that phase, we would still probably be cocky individuals.
It was an exercise in humility and lowering your own ego. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. People will come and tell you. Everyone has to go through that phase where you bomb and you don't succeed. But it helps you sort of value the work that goes into creating good art. And then I know the Black Earth that I've listened to, and you guys are incredible. So,
thanks.
I don't believe you when you said we used to suck.
Oh my god!
You have to believe us on that one. You're pretty bad.
Yeah. A lot of the times, these performances were competitions, right? So there were these. It was kind of a battle of the bands, and usually the same judges would show up to different competitions. So the crowd may be different, but it's usually the same three or four judges who are coming to judge you. And this at one point, when we had quote unquote succeeded, one judge was nice enough to come on stage and say, okay, this competition, Black Earth wins this competition, but let me tell you guys this. These guys were the crappiest, most cocky band when I first judged them 2 years ago. And now they are, I can confidently say that they've put in their work and they deserve this.
Wow.
So it was the same judge who came up and said this. And this was, and by the way, the judge who said this was Sujay Hathi, who's from Bhumi. And he is,
He's an incredible vocalist himself. Yeah.
I remember somebody distinctly telling me also, at that time I had this attitude of like, how can you tell me I suck? So somebody one time once came and told me, how come you never use your little finger, your pinky in playing guitar? Like, you never seem to use it. Like, and so I took it as like, oh, he thinks I suck, huh? He really thinks I suck. That's fine. I'll show him who can use the pinky finger. So, and then so it was like a dedicated effort to show this person who told me this reviewer, I will be the greatest user of the pinky finger that ever walked the earth. So the next many
use
weeks
every
were spent.
Limb and appendage. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, I cannot. Yeah. And at that time, if there was anybody who could play faster than me and this and that, I'm like, that's it. I have to practice 8 hours a day. Now I have to beat this guy. Wow. Now I'm not as violently competitive anymore. I think I'm getting old or something. But I
all the cockiness of youth is
also, it's gone.
It's wearing off.
The cockiness of youth, yeah. So you've got to give props to that auntie also, right? Who came up, held your face and said, you're going to be big someday. Because I think recognizing that also is important. Because now that we're sort of on the other side, and when I see young folks put themselves out there, this could even be something like a talk or a presentation at work, something technical. It could even be that. If they did a good job, I mean, they blew it out of the water, I make it a point to go and tell them that, look, this was great. I mean, I give them the feedback, because I know that when I was in their shoes, when I was starting off, that kind of feedback was very electric. It made you act on it, do things better, and do something with it, right? I mean, it again, even that feedback that people gave me played an important role in shaping my own personality.
Yeah.
There are a lot of small stages in San Francisco and the Bay Area where I go to small music shows. Well, most of these musicians are just starting off. That's why they're coming to these small places. So I take the time to just stop after and tell them that, look, this was good, this is what I enjoyed, and give them some, and they really appreciate it.
You know why? Because as artists, we get so much rejection. Critics are sometimes so terrible to us, and it's always about, if you've not done a good job, then there's this distaste that you have to deal with, as if you've done something wrong. But I think when things do work, please give that feedback, because that is what keeps us going. And if that lady hadn't told me that, I don't know if I would ever have the courage to. So it's important to be that catalyst. And we don't realize how much power words have, and how much a genuine, heartfelt compliment or an acknowledgement of someone's art and their work and their craft, it goes a long way in terms of defining their life. So who knows how many lives you've touched, Subodh, by just talking to them and telling them what you genuinely felt about their craft. So, I'm glad that we're talking about this, because it's important to acknowledge people's efforts and acknowledge good art when you see it. Because not often do we get that feedback. It's usually negative feedback that crowds our experience. Yeah.
So we took a segue after your blockbuster show. So what happened after that tripling of the budget and bigger shows at
Infosys? Oh my God. A lot of good things and a lot of bad things. So obviously, like, everyone was talking about the show. So my team that I was working for was also sort of hearing about this. Oh, Priyanka from your team. Yeah, we saw her in this play. And they're like, okay, she could have been working. You know, there's this thing in India that if you're done with your work, then ask for more work. Like, if you stay at the office until 10 p.m., then you're doing really good. Like, the idea of being so good at your work that you finish everything on time and you wrap up and you leave by 5 p.m. is looked down upon. You're not working hard enough. So there's that toxic sort of mentality. And then suddenly it would sort of creep into conversations with my the team lead or something, and would say, yeah, you go do theater. I think you're meant for that. Little snide comments.
Oh my God. It's so demotivating.
And then at some point I was like, yeah, maybe he's right. Maybe I should. But a lot of the other things that came out of it was that it was also, like, how it was opening doors for me, it was also opening doors for other people who were employed at that software company in terms of wanting to do more art, wanting to create more art. And they were either involved in more of the shows that we did eventually, or they got into filmmaking and short films and things. It started finding these other outlets. It was almost like infectious, that once that spark was lit, like we couldn't let it die. It just kept feeding more and more things and more projects. The more you put yourself out there, the more things come to you. Like just this performance, going back to New York last week, the last two weekends, has led to so many other people saying, oh, you have to come to Colorado. You have to come to Ohio. You have to come to this place where I live, LA. And who knows, it may actually lead to things because people know other people, and word of mouth is the best thing ever. So I guess that's what ended up happening. And I know at least two other people who I did those plays with ended up pursuing arts as a career. Amazing. Right. So,
wow.
Yeah. So you never know, like you're being a catalyst in many ways. By just creating art, you may be opening doors for someone else. And I felt the same even with my university when I started creating original work, and I started involving my students in my plays. I started involving my peers who were other like costume designers and lighting designers and set designers. I started involving them in whatever I was doing. And then that led to more gigs. So... and more things on their resume. Every time this play went to the Kennedy Center, they also went to the Kennedy Center, right? So I just think there's something amazing about creating something and sharing all of the good things that come out of it with everyone. It just opens more doors for us eventually.
That's a great takeaway for people who have arts in the back of their mind. They're like, I don't know, should I do it? Or should I always do software engineering or like, go get an engineering degree like so many people do, even though for no fault of their own, not, you know, everybody is cut out to do engineering. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we may maybe we're producing way too many engineers from India than we should, and not enough artists and people who do a variety of things. And that's one of the things I would say maybe the US provides definitely more of. There's more encouragement, I feel, here to doing something like that. Whereas in India,
it's totally looked down on. Yeah, it's viewed as an actual career, which is great.
Yes.
When people say you're an actor, they most often, they don't laugh. They're like, oh, they take you seriously.
And I think the other thing is for the general population, I don't know if it applies to everybody, but it does to me. But in my mind, acting always puts me in the land of Hollywood here, which is not far from me. So, but acting, everybody doesn't have to become Angelina Jolie or Brad Pitt or whoever these big people names are. That is not the end all of acting. There's like a whole variety of things you can do before you get there. And as parents of children who want to do the art, they should understand that, no, your child is not thinking of becoming Brad Pitt. There are a whole lot of other interests. You know, they probably equate it to like, why you want to go and stand in these fake explosions? That's meaningless. No. So yeah. It can be satisfying.
And people, even here in America, like if I tell neighbors or someone that I'm an actor, the question that comes is, are you in something that I've seen? And they always... you assume that it's a movie or Netflix, or but they don't realize that what it takes to even get a one-line role in a Netflix show, right? Or that there are other forms like theater where who never even seek out opportunities on Netflix, like theater actors. A lot of Broadway performers, people don't know who they are. People don't know their names unless you're really, you know, a theater goer. So there are incredibly gifted performers, actors whose name no one knows. And come to think of it, Edinburgh Fringe, I watched, the first time I got to know about this festival even was Thermal and a Quarter went to Edinburgh Fringe, and they released a docufilm sort of a thing called WFW DFD. If you can try and watch that, it's on YouTube.
We will definitely do that. And also as a context, Thermal and a Quarter is probably one of the most successful bands. I mean, it's a handful of successful bands out of India, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've really made a nice international presence for themselves too. Their genre of music, they call it Bangalore rock, and they're one of my favorite bands, and I've been following them for quite some time. But I was still in India at this point, not completely switched over from engineering to acting, and I saw this documentary or short film that they released, and it was basically documenting their experience at the Fringe. But in the background, it's Bruce Lee Money's voice. I think it was also written by Rajiv Rajagopal. It was about what it takes to be an artist. Why is it that some people are crazy enough to leave their cushy software jobs or corporate jobs and pursue something as crazy as this and die in ignominy most of the times, right? A very small percentage of artists succeed in what they do.
For sure.
But that doesn't mean that only that percentage of artists were good at what they do, right? So there's footage of these performers at Edinburgh Fringe who just have perfected and mastered their craft, and they're just on the streets performing or in little venues there with no guarantee of success, with no guarantee of recognition. But they're doing it because they love their craft, and every day they want to get a little better at their craft than they were the previous day. And it just amazed me so much that there is this breed of artists out there for whom, you know, the recognition or success or any sort of external validation is not the point of what they're doing. They're doing it surely because of their love for whatever art that they are into, right? So, and that spark of, oh, someday I want to go to Edinburgh Fringe came into my head. And I, at that point, I didn't even know that I would go there. Forget with a solo show that I wrote on my own. I had no idea. This was probably 2015 is when this happened. But that's how the idea of Edinburgh Fringe came into my mind. I know it's a bit of a segue, but I think it was related to this whole idea of being an artist and doing what you do without the need for that validation or approval, or even the fact that people like this exist whom it doesn't matter if you succeed or not. That's amazing and so inspiring and humbling.
Like for yourself, right? This must be such a satisfying feeling. Like you set out this goal of, hey, it'll be nice to be at the Fringe Festival on some day, and making it a reality. You should be proud of yourself. Yeah.
I think it was, guys know this band called Slain from Bangalore? Anyway, so they were a power metal band. And the bassist now, I think, is with Raghu Dixit Project. He said, Priyanka, you're a doer of things. You're always doing something. That's actually a very great description of me. I'm just like randomly trying to do things and hoping something works. And it's a bit of that hustler mentality, I guess. Yeah. But And there's this whole talk about manifesting and all of that, and which can be a problematic word, because then it's like, oh, you just keep thinking about things and then it becomes a reality. No, there's action associated with that. But I guess it's a great feeling that something that I thought of, oh, I wonder if I'll ever, is now happening, and I'm flying there in 2 days, that close to it happening is truly magical and wonderful now looking back at it, now that I just told you what the origin of that was. But I guess it's because I'm a doer of things, and it's very random. It's not something great. It's just little things that add up and lead to something. And then you just keep riding that wave, and then something else comes up. It's a little chaotic, but...
So since you mentioned Raghu Dixit, right? I hope I'm not misremembering the story, but sometime in 2005 when Black Earth was recording, we were recording our EP, our album, at a studio in Bangalore. And at that time, Raghu Dixit had just broken off from his previous band, Antaragini. He was still looking for success, working the system. And I guess he was not popular yet. So this was 2005. So we would record our music from morning until evening at the studio. And the studio owner, Anirban Chakrabarty, so he was good friends with Raghu Dixit. And so when it was time for us to pack up, we would see Raghu Dixit coming over for chai and just having a chat with him. And this was in 2005. And it is... At that time, I think even for like from a musician's point of view, right? I mean, it was like, man, it's hard to get success in this field, right? And you would see Raghu Dixit, and he's still sort of a nobody. And seeing him like so many years later, like 15 years later, he's the face of Indian folk music at this point. So there's something to be said about persevering. I guess you got to go through 1,000 failures to see one success.
Exactly.
I think art is uniquely positioned in that way, I think. You unfortunately have to see through a lot more failures than, say, something like software engineering.
Yeah, and you can't be fazed by it, because success eventually comes as a result of putting your work out there over and over again. And I'm sure Raghu Dixit is a big-time hustler. I'm sure he did hundreds of gigs where maybe two people were in the audience, and then something clicked along the way, which led him to where he is today. And that is unfortunately the nature of art, whether it's in India, America, wherever else, is that it's kind of dependent on who are the gatekeepers and are they letting you in. But you do have some agency in that, especially if you're taking your art in your own hands and creating your own stuff, right? That you're not waiting for people to recognize your talent and give you those roles or opportunities, right? But eventually it does come down to other people saying yes to you. Yeah. So, and it is, like you said, how many times can you keep doing and persevering at what you're doing until the doors finally open? But there's also a lot of people who give up halfway, and really no judgment with that, because it is hard. And some people just realize that they don't want to spend their life waiting and trying and hustling. They want something more consistent. And I completely respect that. And so it really purely comes down to choice. What are you willing to do, and how badly do you want something?
Priyanka, we've spoken about so many things, right? I mean, we've covered everything that we wanted to talk about: art, theater, you know, how it all fits into culture and how it all fits into a young individual's life, and so much. Now, the one thing I have to say in the way of wrapping our conversation up is, see, before the show, we were talking about how the most important thing of a project is its name, the name that you give a project, right? So by way of that, I must say that The Elephant in the Room is such, it's just perfect. It's a fantastic name. And I think you've really done well with picking this name, because when you are at a big festival like the Fringe Festival and you have like 100 performances and things like that, if I saw something like The Elephant in the Room, unfortunately, humans do judge a book by its cover, but I think you've set yourself up for some real good success. Because if I see a name like The Elephant in the Room, I'm going to you know what? I'm going to go check that out. That's really
good to know. I mean, even though it's a cliche, it's used a lot. That title, in fact, has led to some beautiful discoveries in the play itself, because the elephant has so many, there are so many phrases associated with it, like what is a white elephant, what is a circus elephant. So all of those metaphors associated with elephant and its qualities, I'm able to explore in this play. And it has rendered itself very beautifully to the different themes in this. So I'm also happy to hear that it's catchy enough that you'd want to see it. So that's great.
Yeah. And all of it, it's very clear that you're an exceptionally creative person, because the way you laid out your triptych, like the elephant in the room, and you are keeping yourself busy for the next 2 years, 2023 and 2024, with hashtag Charlottesville and the wall, and it's very, the way you clearly think about your goals and what you're setting out to do and laying it out in this way is really inspiring. I think it's going to give me something to think about after this and see how I can actually incorporate that kind of clear thinking in my own work.
I'm telling you, it's organized chaos. It's just a structure, but inside that structure, everything is chaotic, I promise you.
Yeah. And you know what? Actually, the other thing is that even the artwork that you came up with, The Elephant Room, even all of that is fantastic. You have dotted your I's and crossed your T's. From my point of view, from where I'm sitting, right? It seems like you have mastered everything that is in your control. Okay. I mean, of course, things like the 5 minutes of house music playing in the middle of it. So that
those
is out
variables.
Of your control, of course. But everything, those are the variables. But I think that you are doing a fantastic job in the way of setting yourself for success. And I think you're just getting started in your journey. We are all eagerly waiting to see what is to come and how big you become.
That means the world to me. Thank you, Subbu. And for those who are listening, Subbu is my health and fitness consultant. So if you see me survive Edinburgh Fringe, all that stamina came from talking to Subbu. Aww. So I want to plug that in 100%.
Thank you.
He has a side gig as a nutrition coach.
He's incredibly amazing. Nice. So you've already helped me a lot, because New York, I was totally fine. I was performing and then hanging out with people and not hitting a wall. So it has everything to do with your coach.
That is fantastic. See, now I just have to practice what I preach, because I tell you all these things and then I then go drink a milkshake. I was telling Vikram this. So I better get myself in line now. And the other thing is that this is like a call out to the listeners, right? Okay, here, I haven't said this before. When I first came to the US, my part-time job during graduate studies was, I was an employee of the university theater.
Really?
I did the sound, I did the lights, I did backstage on many of the shows. And one of the perks that comes with being an employee of the university theater is I can go in and watch any show. Of course, I don't have a seat, so I would go up and sit on the catwalks.
Not even get a drink, go and sit
in the catwalks. Not in the booth, yeah. And then, I mean, because actually, of course, the catwalks is the best view, right up, right from the top. It is some of the best experiences of my life. I can't say this about too many things, but those 2 years at the theater was just, it was something new. I mean, I had never been in a theater, and spending so much time in it and watching all these people put themselves out was quite an experience. So for the listeners, at this point, every city has a pretty good theater or a repertory center, whatever they may call it. And so if you haven't, take this podcast, take this opportunity to go see what is running next year, next to where you live, and go and check out some theater close to you. You'll be happy you did so, and it is so addictive.
Ah, I love that you said that. Thank you.
And also, right, as you said initially, the life an artist can at times seem lonely. I mean, you're setting out, you're doing so much, you're investing so much of your time, right? Now, but then we don't want you to feel like lonely. We want to be, in a way, like Vikram, us, the listeners, how can we support you? How can we help you as you go through all of this, all these performances and travel and all of that? What's the best way for us to support you?
I think like having just been through a run where I felt extremely supported is really just coming out to see our work when we do put it out there. And that's also not an expectation, because, you know, even with musicians, we say support the scene and come see the gigs. But then if they don't enjoy the music, then I guess you can't force anyone to do that. But check out the work and see if you like it, right? Because it's a struggle getting people to the theaters itself. They don't even know that the work is good. They don't even know that good stuff happens out there, that they don't even know that they like it. So, which is why I love what you said, is go check out what's happening in a theater close to where you live. Because if you don't, then you'll never know that what you're missing out on, right? So the biggest thing people can do is come check out our work. And if they like what they see, and if they like those theaters or those artists, then they can continue to follow them and be a part of their journey. And the other thing is, just keep a tab on what artists are up to and what they're doing, and just be a part of that world a little more. Then I think that word of mouth thing is gonna help bring more and more people into it. Because let's say I like Black Earth's music, and I introduce a friend to it, they may become your lifelong followers, right? So I guess that's the simplest ask, is to check out the work, and if you like it, tell other people about it. Really, that's all we ask.
Yeah, and follow Priyanka on Instagram. We'll have those links down there. And do you have any Patreon or any sort of a way for us to contribute towards all of this setup and travel?
I do have a fundraiser through Fractured Atlas that I set up for the Edinburgh Fringe and the UK tour specifically. And I can share the link with you, and you can put that in for people.
We will put that in the show notes.
We'll totally do that.
Thank you. Yeah, that would be great.
Thanks for coming on, Priyanka, and sharing with us all these exciting stories of theater on the road. And good luck on your trip to Scotland. And may all your dreams come true, because I know you've been waiting for this a long, long time.
Thank you so much. It was such a perfect way for me to go into this upcoming adventure, by just taking stock of everything that has happened so far, what I've just been through with the performances in New York, and now take all of that into this next adventure that awaits. So this was perfectly timed. And thank you, Subbu and Vikram, for making this possible.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Half-Life Show. This episode and all previous episodes are available on Spotify, iTunes, or any other platform that you get your podcasts from. If you would like to reach out to us, we'd love to hear from you. Our Instagram handle is @halflife.show. All episodes are also available on our website, www.halflife.show.